Shalom, everyone. I'm Josiah Jeffrey.
I'm Hosea Jeffrey.
And we're back discussing the Torah portions. This week, we're looking at the portion of Bahar, which goes from Leviticus 25:1 to 26:2. On some years, this portion is read along with the next portion, Bechukotai. So be sure to check the pinned comment below to see if you should read both portions or just this one this week. We've already read the portion ahead of time, so if you'd like to go ahead and read it as well, why don't you go ahead and pause the video and do that, and then we'll get into discussing.
In Bahar, God instructs the people of Israel with the rules for the Shabbat years and Jubilee years, outlining God's cycle of renewal and redemption for the land, property, and people of Israel.
So this portion begins with God giving Moses the basic instructions for what's called the Shabbat year, or in English, the Sabbath year. Basically, he outlines an agricultural cycle where the people of Israel are supposed to harvest and plow and plant their fields for 6 years, and then on the seventh year, they don't do any farm work, they just let the land rest. We had actually briefly read about this concept previously in Exodus, and as the name Shabbat year suggests, it was actually paired with the seventh day Shabbat, where you work for 6 days, and then the people rest on the seventh day. Here, it's basically saying that rather than the people working for 6 days and resting on the seventh day, in this case, the land is working for 6 years, and then the land rests on the seventh year. In fact, it goes so far as to say that the Shabbat year is what's called a Shabbat Shabbaton for the land. We had read previously that a Shabbat Shabbaton is basically the highest level of rest possible, and so far it's only been reserved for the seventh day Shabbat and the Shabbat of Yom Kippur. So this is basically showing that the rest that the land is supposed to enjoy during the seventh year is really, really, really restful, and it's also super duper important for the land.
Now, like you said, the Shabbat year is a Shabbat for the land. And what that means is that you have to not work the land. No sowing, no planting of crops, and no reaping what's grown in that year. You have 6 years to plant all your crops and do all your reaping, but in the seventh year, you just leave the land alone. Let it do its thing. Now, the result of the people of Israel giving the land this rest is that they're not planting crops for themselves. So they're not harvesting that full yield from their own fields. It says that you can eat some of what grows in the field, but you can't go out and harvest it. So you're not building up a storehouse full of this year's food. Now, naturally, this will result in some apprehension when you can't grow a crop for an entire year, and most of the people of Israel are going to be relying on these crops for the food to survive. But God then goes on to tell the people of Israel that if they follow all his rules, that he will bless them by giving them a triple crop in the sixth year. The result of this is that in the sixth year, they'll be able to eat from their crop, and then in the seventh year, they'll be able to keep eating from that crop. And then in the eighth year, when they plant their new crop, they'll still be eating some of the old crop. So God is promising the people of Israel, yes, for a whole year, you're not going to be sowing or reaping, but rely on me, and I will provide for you. I will give you more than you need through the entire time that you're giving the land its rest, as long as you are following my rules.
This is very similar to what God told the Israelites on the very first Shabbat when he was giving them manna, and he said on the sixth day, on Friday, you'll get a double portion of manna and you'll gather a double portion, and then on Shabbat, there won't be any manna out there. Don't gather anything. So God is basically saying, on Shabbat, eat the leftovers I provide for you. And on the Shabbat year, eat the leftovers that I provide for you. God is saying, trust in my provision. If you obey me, then you can trust that I will provide for you. Put obedience to me first, then you get the leftovers, and the leftovers will be more than enough. It reminds me of what Yeshua says when he said, seek first the reign and his righteousness, and all of these things will be added to you. God is saying, put obedience first. Put my Shabbat first. This is just as much of a Shabbat for the land as the seventh day is a Shabbat for Israel. Put my Shabbat, my commands first, and then I will provide for you. I will see to it that you have everything that you need.
So after establishing that this seven-year cycle is supposed to exist for the land, God then says, when you count seven of these seven-year cycles, 49 years and seven of the Shabbat years, on the 50th year, you have what's called the year of Jubilee. And so at every cycle, in the 49th year, on Yom Kippur, actually, you sound the shofar to signal that the next year is going to be the year of Jubilee. And that's a holy year. And God says that it's a year to proclaim liberty to all the inhabitants of Israel and for all the people of Israel to return to their property and to their clans. Like the Shabbat year, the Jubilee year is a year where you cannot sow or reap in your field. But in addition, you also have with the Jubilee year this concept of the property returning to its owners. If land has been bought or sold at any point, it will revert to the original owner of the property at the Jubilee year.
Basically, God says that no land in Israel should be sold permanently. It's essentially bought and sold on a loan or a pawn system where you calculate how many years it is to the next Jubilee, and then you pay the price based on how many harvests you would get out of it from the time you purchase it to the next Jubilee year. And so then, as soon as the Jubilee year comes, all the land that had been bought and sold in the past 50 years will suddenly be changing hands and going back to the original owners and going back to their ancestral claims.
What's really interesting is that God says here, the land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine, for you are strangers and sojourners with me. So God is saying, the land that you're going into, yes, I'm giving it to the people of Israel, but it's my land. Mm. The people of Israel are just sojourning there. And so God is basically saying, when the people of Israel receive this land, it's because I'm giving it to them. And it still belongs to me, even when I give it to them. So the people of Israel don't have the right to sell that land, to change who it belongs to, because it belongs to God. And God apportions it to whoever he wants. We're going to see that God divides the land inheritances for the people of Israel, giving one inheritance to each tribe. They can't sell the land to change those inheritances because God is the one who owns the land and God is the one who gives those inheritances. So those inheritances will always belong to the people to whom God gave them. And the Jubilee serves as a sort of reset to keep it that way forever.
Now with the Jubilee year, all of this about the properties returning to their original owners, that specifically applies for fields and stuff like that. It does not actually apply for houses within walled cities. Within walled cities, you can just buy and sell like normal. There's no inherent property right to that. You just buy it and sell it. It specifically says that if the house is out in a village somewhere, then that house is considered part of the field that it's on. So then it would revert in the year of Jubilee. But the year of Jubilee is specifically about large plots of land. It's about the land, not about the houses. So if you're just buying houses inside a city, then the Jubilee doesn't apply. Now, one exception to this that we read about is in the case of the Levites. God says here that the Levites are going to get their own cities. And no matter what happens, those cities belong to Levites. So if a Levite has sold a house in that city, then when the year of Jubilee comes around, they have the right to get that house back because everything in that city belongs to Levites.
God says this is because the houses in the cities of the Levites are their possession among the people of Israel. So as we already said, God's going to be dividing the land of Israel into land inheritances. But Levi actually isn't going to get a land inheritance like the other tribes are. We're going to see more about this later. Instead, aside from their unique service as God's priests, their only physical inheritance is going to be these cities scattered throughout Israel. So these cities and the houses in them need to remain in Levite hands because that's their possession from God.
Now, the other main aspect of the year of Jubilee is that it's a year for freeing Hebrew slaves. God basically says that when there's a poor Israeli, you shouldn't treat him badly. But in some cases, an Israeli might be so poor that he needs to sell himself into slavery to survive, to pay off his debts and such. And so in that case, God says, first of all, don't treat him badly. Treat him like a hired worker. Don't treat him as a full-on slave. But then also it says that in the year of Jubilee, he and his family get to go free. All debts paid, they are free, and they can go back to their tribes. Now, even though a Hebrew can sell himself as a slave because he's so poor, that isn't like other kinds of slavery where there's a whole slave trade and a subclass of slaves in society. These are just people who have sold themselves to a specific individual that they're indebted to. And he's not property that can just be sold around.
God says that the people of Israel can't be selling each other as slaves because they are his slaves. He says, "They are my slaves whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. They shall not be sold as slaves." Most translations will actually say, "They are my servants." But the Hebrew word is identical to all the other places in this passage which are talking about slaves. God is saying the people of Israel are his slaves. They belong to him for his service. A few verses earlier, he said that he brought them out of the land of Egypt to give them the land of Canaan and to be their God. And we've seen other places where he talks about them being his treasured possession. The people of Israel were brought out of Egypt for God. We were told God redeemed them. In a way, he purchased them such that they belong to him. They are his slaves. And so since all the people of Israel belong to God, they can't be belonging to one another indefinitely. All the people of Israel are equal in God's sight in that they're all his slaves. And so for all the people of Israel, their loyalty is ultimately not to the people who purchased them, because they're freed from that through God, who owns them. Their loyalty is to God, who owns them, who brought them out of Egypt to be his people, and who always sets them free every Jubilee year.
This reminded me of something that we read in Romans, where Paul says, "For when you were slaves of the sin, you were free from the righteousness. But now, having been freed from the sin, and having become slaves to God, you have your fruit leading to holiness, and the end result is life, age enduring." So Paul basically says that we used to be slaves to sin, but then God set us free and made us slaves of God. So we went from one slavery to another, which is basically what God is saying in Leviticus. He's saying, you were slaves in Egypt, but I set you free, made you my people, and now you are slaves of me. The people of Israel are enslaved to God, or at least we should be. Paul explains this, "Have you not known that to whom you present yourselves as slaves for obedience, you are slaves to whom you obey, whether of sin to death or of obedience to righteousness? Whoever we obey, we are enslaved to. And so if we obey God and keep his commands, then we will be his slaves and we will be righteous. But if we obey ourselves, if we obey sin, if we obey our flesh, then the result is death. And we are enslaved to that sin and to that death." And so through Yeshua's sacrifice, he has redeemed us from that slavery to sin. And so now we belong to God and we need to act like it. We need to obey him. We should be honoring him even in how we're treating other people. In fact, Paul will say to slaves who believe in Yeshua, he says, "The slaves, obey in all things those who are your masters according to the flesh. Whatever you do, do it out of your soul as to the master and not to men, having known that from the master you will receive the payment of the inheritance. It is the master, Messiah, you serve." So even when we are serving other people, even if we're literally slaves, we should do that as if we're serving God, because we are serving him through our service to other people. We don't belong to any other man. We only belong to Messiah. And so in whatever we do, all of our service should be knowing that he is our true master and he deserves all of our allegiance.
So I think the big takeaway from this portion is to treat everything you have like it belongs to God. The land of the people of Israel was supposed to revert to its owners every Jubilee year because it wasn't really their land. It was God's land. And God was entrusting it to them and telling them, "Respect my rules for it." That's also what they had to do every Shabbat year when they weren't allowed to sow or reap. They were following God's rules for God's land. And God was giving them the blessings of his land when they followed his rules for that land. It's the same with the people. The people themselves can't be oppressing their slaves because their slaves are actually God's slaves. All the people of Israel belong to God and they need to treat each other that way. And indeed, their own service, things they themselves do in their work, they need to do as if they belong to God. And their work is dedicated to God. That's how we should be. We should treat all of our resources, all of our efforts, as if they belong to God, because they do, or at least they should. God is the one who bought us. God is the one who rescued us from the slavery of sin. And so we are his slaves. Everything we have should be his, and we should act accordingly.
That wraps up the portion of Bahar. In the next video, we'll be looking at Bahukotai, so be sure to tune in for that. Thanks so much for watching. Be sure to like, share, comment, subscribe, and hit the notification bell to keep updated on new videos. And if you would, please consider sending us a donation to help us make more videos like these. We would really appreciate it. Thanks again for watching, and we'll see you next time. God bless.